You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on. Good morning, listeners. You are tuned in to the 3CR Gardening Show for your usual Sunday morning. I'm Chloe Foster, and joining me today in the studio is Adrian Keane, arborist.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And Russell Lark with a new job title. He's so excited about it. Botanist.
Sounds so good.
At Arthur Weiler Institute.
I'm pretty excited.
Congratulations, Russ.
Thanks, Chloe.
Huge news.
I know.
It is great. Huge news.
Very cool.
The Victorian flora is going to thrive now.
Yeah.
So happy to be back with my babies. It's great. Yeah.
I'm very happy to be sharing the microphone with you guys today, as it is National Tree Day tomorrow, and we've got Adrian, obviously you're an arborist,
correct,
but
yes,
massive fan of the Australian flora and Australian trees.
Love an Australian tree, yeah.
And Russ, you're not an arborist, but you're also a similar fan of things that Adrian's a fan of.
Yeah, I think both of us have got problems when it comes to Australian trees,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Slight obsession, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moderate.
Or massive one.
Moderate to high.
Yeah.
Potentially diagnosable.
Yeah. Well, that's good. We are going to be chatting a lot about trees today and anything else gardening which people might need help on or want to chat about. We're here to take your calls and your messages when the time comes. But National Tree Day, it's been going since, I was looking this up this week, 1996, and it was started by Planet Ark.
Yeah, right.
And there have been there have been tree planting days all across Australia, particularly on the 7th of July, or like the last Sunday or something, I think is what it is officially, ever since then.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's a good initiative.
Yeah. So schools, a lot of people might be familiar with schools doing, or people might have done this through school.
Yes.
I remember doing it in primary school.
Did it at primary school, planting some tube stock.
Yeah, me too.
I remember it quite, in the early days, it was often forestry stock. So there's a lot of blue gums.
Oh, no.
That from Tasmania in Victoria.
That's a sign of like how conservation and our knowledge of the Australian flora has evolved in at least the last 30 or 40
years,
definitely.
Right?
Our understanding of things like provenance and where a species is actually from, and this idea of native versus indigenous, endemic, all those things, has come into play now, which is good.
Yeah. This feels like a side note, but have you ever been to Newport Lakes Reserve?
Yes.
It's a really interesting, like it's a revegetated little, not little, but ecosystem, whatever you want to call it.
Mm.
And we had a tour there by one of the Hobson's Bay horticulturalists. We took some students there and he's like, you know, this is what's planted. There's heaps of WA eucalypts and stuff from and other gum trees from all over Australia. And he said it was an old bluestone mine.
Mm.
It got shut down, or they ran out of bluestone in the late 80s or something. And the community said, we don't want this to be turned into development. We want a public park. We want this to be green space. And it happened, which is awesome.
Mm.
But it's a really interesting snapshot of what we were doing, or our conservation practices back in the late 80s, early 90s, because everyone just used to think like, oh, well, you're revegetating an area, just like chucking any Australian native.
Yeah.
Anything green is good.
With best intention too.
Oh, yes, yeah, absolutely. With all good intentions.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now they're like, you know, you've got Port Phillip Bay a K down the road and you're on the edge of the Victorian volcanic plains and you've got
You feel like you're in the Western Australian wheat belt.
Yeah, seriously, you do.
Mm. Yeah.
But what they're doing now is when something starts to die out or they've got some open area, they're planting a lot of grasses. They're starting to sort of revegetate
shift
it based
that baseline.
On shift it back to what it would have been pre-settlement.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Isn't it?
I didn't notice that when I went there. I know it's to a very high standard.
It is.
They take excellent care of it.
It's a well looked after place, and the nursery is very nice too.
The nursery is
wonderful. So good.
And you can get heaps of species you can't get in other places too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. A lot of that VVP, like the volcanic plains stuff you get from
that place was my go-to to get the Australian native mallow.
Ah, very good. Mm. See, that's a really that's good example niche. Of something that's
super yes. Yeah. Just throwing in a niche one there. Yeah,
yeah. Classic Adrian. What's the native mallow?
It's a malva.
Yeah.
So it's a short-lived perennial or annual with little pink flowers.
What a ripper.
Yeah.
Do you know that one very well?
No, not at all.
Yeah, there's two native malva. So there's one that's coastal.
Yeah.
I think that's – oh, no, I'm not going to stab at species. Mm. There's a coastal Victorian one, and then there's also one found in the Mallee, which is even a bit more specky, and that's got more of a pink, richer pink flower. Mm. Yeah, and they're both very rare.
Yeah, I reckon risk. They are. Yeah.
Like a lot of our herbaceous perennials that are native, they're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
As a collection of plants, they're... Ooh.
But like most of them are probably going to be beautiful garden plants. No?
No, no.
I mean, there's a lot of ephemeral species that are super flowery and beautiful, you know, the swainsonas and things like that.
Oh,
love and sometimes they're rare because, you know, they really rely on... like a particular type of inundation or something. So, you know, you won't see them for 10 years and then you have a flood event or something like that and they start popping up again. So, and I think that probably contributes to why there's not as much seed or as much grown in the nursery industry because it's kind of a bit ad hoc when you can collect some of that seed. But,
the malva being a good example of that.
Yeah.
They're a disturbance ecology plant. So you'll get like mass drifts of them turn up after a bushfire in the Mallee, and then on the coast you only get them in disturbance events, really.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting about these species is, like, you think about – you got to think about gardens as like kind of an ecological system.
Mm.
So in nature, like when you have a disturbance, like a fire or a flood or whatever it may be, some sort of disturbance, like you get those pioneer species, you get those second wave species, like a lot of your peas and stuff start doing their thing and then they'll die out in 3 to 5 years and then, you know, you get more structural shrubs and things like that. And I always like to think about a garden from design. You go, okay, well, like a lot of these herbaceous things in 5 years won't be there and how you kind of stagger your design to be in line with how these plants actually grow. So there's a lot of herbaceous things that you either, you know, they might live for 3 to 5 years. So there's heaps of like, you know, daisies and things like that that won't last that long, but you can kind of use them, like you can replant them every, you know, 3 years or whatever and maintain that effect, or you can let it kind of evolve into the more shrubby things and the more long-lived things. So I think it's a really interesting space. Like a lot of people don't think about lifespan when you think about putting plants in your garden.
But they'll happily put in some pansies or petunias.
Exactly.
For $1 at the nursery.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And that's how I made my coin back in the day when I was a landscaper. You know, like the annual colour and
southeastern
suburbs. Cool. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The primulas.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I'm not okay Russell's remembering that stuff.
Old lady clients and the primulas.
True. Love them. Yeah. I mean, I better not say that, but they're beautiful. Like, they can look.
They have their own quality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But so you decide to either replant those short-lived ones after a few years or move on and put something else in. Or
exactly.
What the woodier stuff that you had growing after a few years isn't now started to fill up that space.
Yeah.
So you don't maybe not need
which
to
is
fill
interesting.
It.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's happening in my garden at the moment. So a lot of my grevilleas have started to mature.
Mm.
Callistemons. The various rutaceae that I grow.
Yeah.
They're all coming into their own. They're at the 3-year mark and they're starting to flower regularly.
Yeah.
And I'll hopefully in 5 years time I can replant the understory.
Yeah.
And go from there.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. We'll see.
Now you've got almost every Victorian coria in your garden. Some crazy fact like that.
On technicality.
Oh, here we go.
I would have every coria. Technically.
What's the technicality?
Well, one of them's a hybrid. So the last coria in my arsenal of corias is Coria amula.
Yeah.
And I cannot get it. But I'm very grateful. Neil Marriott has told me that he's going to grow me some.
So
amazing.
I will finally have Coria amula. And I even went to a nursery recently and they said that they had it and they sold it as that. And then I researched and it was not Coria amula. It was Coria eubernia. The Deep Creek Coria,
okay.
Which I already had at home. So I was like,
Yeah, that hurts. I mean, shout out to Neil Marriott too. He's like one of the great plants people ever, I think. And for, I mean, not only Victoria flora, but...
just in general,
His grevillea collection and hakeas and corias and all sorts of stuff that he's got out at his property at the Black Range. It's pretty phenomenal.
And also just dream property, granite country, perfect native plant soil.
Yeah.
Yes.
Heavenly drainage. Yeah. Oh, the things he can grow.
It's incredible.
And the space to be able to grow
it. The space, yes.
I feel like they're the old kind of Australian plant mafia, you know, when you think about Neil Marriott, you think about Gwen and Roger Elliott, and you think about Trevor Blake and, you know, Elspeth Jacobs is a good mate of mine, like a eucalyptus nut, and like just these people who have kind of paved the way for like us. I can't call myself young when you guys said you were primary school in 96. I'm like, I was in year 10. But anyway, you know, like they are the original gangsters of Australian flora.
Absolutely. Yeah. And living that gangster lifestyle.
Massive. And still doing it too.
Absolutely. Yeah,
the big gold chains and all that
stuff. We'll have an email sitting in our inbox from Roger today from the show telling what we did well and what we didn't. Like he's keeping us on the straight and narrow.
And to be fair, we need it.
You more so than anyone. Going back to primary school tree planting, I remember doing, I reckon it must have been the first National Tree Day when I did it in grade one. So if anyone can do some maths, you now know how old I am. and I remember planting a callistemon, a bottle brush, and near my, that planting is still there at my primary school. If you go by, my callistemon didn't make it, unfortunately.
Oh, that's a bummer.
But there's some spotted gums, Crimea maculata.
They're another one that turns up.
Yeah.
Mm. And then swamp mahoganies, eucalyptus botryoides, they're everywhere.
Maculata is not too bad, but swamp mahogany and eucalyptus globulus.
Yeah.
Like,
in Melbourne, really? Yes.
Like the sugar gum.
Everyone loved the sugar gum.
But if you see botryoides like out east in its natural habitat, they are gorgeous, some of the most beautiful trees you'd ever see. You know, like we get a bit grumpy because they can be a bit weedy. Like they self seed and do that thing. Yeah. But in their natural habitat, oh my God, they're beautiful trees.
Another weird thing about them I've noticed in Melbourne, they're prone to rot.
Are they?
Yeah.
The botryoides?
Yep.
They
get a lot of insect damage. So.
Yeah, okay.
They just get smashed. Yeah. Right. They're just not a very resilient tree in Melbourne. Really quick growing and then they fall apart.
Well, that's why Eucalyptus cladocalyx was used a lot, because it was a quick growing. It was used as like a woodlot tree most of the time.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm.
Grew quickly and it was, you know, a denser hardwood.
Yeah.
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 And we're having problems with those in Melbourne now as well. Like at my local council, a lot of them have started to die. And it's that ginger syndrome thing. So the vascular tissue in the trees collapsing from too much extreme heat and extreme cold and too much water, not enough water.
Oh.
It's really sad.
Talk me through this a little bit more. So did you call it ginger syndrome?
Yeah, that's a colloquial name for it.
Right.
It has a special term. My colleague, who's far better with specific terms, told me the right thing and I was like, oh, okay, that's got it.
Thank you. I can't remember that. Yeah.
Straight in one ear out the other. I was like, damn, you are really smart. So the vascular tissue in the tree collapses because the tree either gets too hot or too cold or too wet or too dry. And so with climate change, we're having these extremities of weather. And so, like, recently we've got a street of Lecoxolans and we've lost about 80% of them from this phenomenon. Yeah, it's really bad.
Is this happening elsewhere in the world?
It happens it's really notable in eucalypts, particularly the smooth-barked eucalypts, because you can see the presentation. So you can see it as it's happening, but it affects all eucalypt.
And what does it look like from the outside of the
tree? So the sap oozes out of the tree. So you know when you get canker in Cyprus and you get those little pock marks and then there's sap coming out? It's the same as that, but it stains the whole tree because eucalypts produce kino, and it discolours the whole tree. Yeah.
Right. So in Oz, probably the most studied system is the Viminalis in Tassie.
Yes.
So it's actually destroying a lot of those kind of wet sclerophyll forests and stuff down in Tassie.
Right.
So, yeah, if you're interested, there might be three people listening who are interested in this.
Yeah.
Just type in ginger syndrome and there's a good ABC article about it occurring in Tassie.
Yep.
So it's a big problem in Tasmania on the, you know, the grassland when you drive from Launceston to Hobart?
Yeah.
So that used to be a Viminalis grassland and now they can't really grow the Viminalis because they die of ginger syndrome.
Okay.
And caterpillars and stuff.
So, okay, this is really interesting because I think about horticulture in terms of like hort in Melbourne and say in the last 30 to 40 years and what's been going on climatically in the last 30 or 40 years.
Mm.
We had the millennium drought where it was just like so crazy dry. And we were looking at some rainfall maps in class the other day, some, you know, the bomb climate data stuff. And the Preston Reservoir weather station has records back to the late 1800s.
Oh, wow.
Yes, it was so cool.
That'd be fascinating.
It was fascinating. And you know what was so much fascinating is there was just like this general up and down of annual rainfall, you know, within a range over time. And then there was this like chunk of 15 years where there was like nothing. And I looked at the date and it was from about the mid 90s until about 2010 or something.
Jesus.
And I was like, that was, and I showed my students, I thought, that was the millennium drought. Some of them are not even old enough to remember that. And I was like, that was a millennium drought. And then, so there was that extended dry period, which was severe.
Mm.
And then what came after that was like two or three really wet years.
Yeah.
Mm. And we started seeing...
Remember those summers? They were horrendous. Because like we kind of grew up in drought and then suddenly we're getting excessively wet weather.
Yeah.
And each summer it was just pissing down rain and like 28 degrees and humid. Like, what is this?
Well, that's actually the projection. Like, so we're going to have drier winters
and then really wet summers.
Concentrated like downpour. So it's going to make gardening much harder, you know, because you're going to get these, you know, especially on free draining or sandy soil, you're going to lose a lot of that moisture, especially in summer.
Mm. You'll lose a lot of our indigenous eucalypts because they're not evolved to grow over summer. They grow in winter and flower in winter. Like they're tolerant and variable, but it's not looking good.
Yeah.
Like because we've got problems with our red gun populations in McLeod and Bundoora as well. They keep getting smashed by psyllids and then there's dieback events and it's just a general slow weakening of the entire population.
Mm. Yeah, right.
And I think reddies and trees that have to go through that kind of cycle of inundation, they're probably the most at risk.
Yeah.
You know, some of the black box and that sort of stuff up through Mallee Country. Like they're the ones that probably don't get the water that they need. So there's, you know, in Hattacolcon and things like that, they're looking at how they inundate these species and tracking kind of the survival of seedlings and that sort of stuff. So they're opening up some of the water allocation to be able to kind of do environmental flooding, which is amazing. Yeah. I think the quirk of Australian trees, especially, like we don't have any deciduous trees apart from, you know,
Melia.
Like, and the Nothofagus down in Tassie, like that's very niche. But it is to be able to take advantage of these kind of, you know, rainfall events whenever they happen, like because our climate's, like, you know, compared to, you know, a stable northern hemisphere climate, like it is so variable. So they need leaves there to go, okay, well, I want to take advantage of this rain when I can and that sort of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see what trees can take advantage of that and what can't. But yeah, definitely those trees that need flooding or at least, you know, like serious inundation, they're struggling. So reddies are the pin up for Melbourne.
Yeah,
fascinating.
Last time you were on, or earlier this year when you were on with Peter May, you guys were talking about winter watering.
Yes.
And it's popped into my head a number of times. Bit of a Roman Empire since. And you mentioned it sort of just before too, what with these potential changing when the rainfall happens of the year. For us in Melbourne, our rainfall happens in the cooler period of the year, whereas in subtropical, tropical areas.
Yeah, exactly.
It's happening in the hottest period of the year.
Yeah.
If we're projected to be going into that,
how
do we deal with it? And yeah, like this winter watering thing.
Yeah. And recharging the groundwater and that sort of stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas that doesn't happen, even if we are watering in summer, watering our gardens, the water doesn't recharge as much.
Yeah, because they either use it or, you know, in cases where there's like really concentrated rainfall, what we're going to see, like, it'll disappear. I mean, it depends on your soil.
So, like, should I be, if it's pouring down rain
mm-hmm.
on a cold June day, mm-hmm. should I be outside with the hose on?
I infamously remember Don Burke.
Oh.
Controversial Don Burke.
Yeah.
He was out with a hose in the middle of winter on his show and he's like, it's great to get extra water out when it's raining.
Mm. No way.
Yeah. It's stuck in my mind.
And it probably depends on what your soil profile looks for looks like and whether or not it's storing water or not. And, you know, you can always – I'm massive on a couple of tools for your soils. Like the big corer where you can, you know, get – 2 meters of soil data just from banging a big metal rod into the ground and dragging it out, and you'll actually see how much moisture is in the ground and where, mm-hmm. what height. And then the other tool, not related to moisture, is the penetrometer. And this thing, it sounds awful. Like, and Chloe nearly reached for the dump button then, but this is actually the technical term. It tests your soil compaction. So you walk around and you press it into the ground and it will give you the PSI of how compact your soil is. So anything over 300, like it's starting to get dodgy. Okay. So you can do an entire, like you could do a couple of hectares in a morning and kind of map that and understand what's going on with your soil profile. So like for gardeners at home, those two things are just the best.
Where do you get those from?
Oh, you can get them around. Like I got them from, there's a guy who still hand makes them in Queensland, which is really cool, and he puts a lot of work into it, and but you can get them, like if you just looked up penetrometer, like you'll be able to find it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And the
soil corer will come from the same sort of places.
Oh, the same person. Yeah, okay.
But I think soil is all about, you know, you can do a million tests on chemical and physical properties, but if you go out and you don't even need a penetrometer. Sometimes you can just jump on a shovel, and if you put 2 feet on it, it doesn't go in, you've got some issues. Yeah. Nothing's growing in there, probably apart from a Melaleuca or a tea tree. Yeah.
There'll be a Melaleuca styphaloides going
off. Yeah, exactly, just doing its thing. Yeah. And, you know, you can dig a hole as well with a shovel and look at the profile and just kind of shear it off. But, yeah, I mean, it makes your life a bit easier because you're not, you know, removing massive holes, you know, putting massive holes in your garden and that sort of stuff. You can just take those little cores. So
that core would help to just aerate it, chuck some compost down that core and get some organic matter deeper into potentially. The soil profile anyway, if it is, if you can get the core down as far as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So get out there and get your penetrometers, people.
Yeah. I would come to it. Do some winter watering. Yeah. All right, you are listening to the 3CR Gardening Show this morning. I'm Chloe Foster. In the studio with me is Adrian Keane and Russell Lark. We are celebrating National Tree Day and anything else related to gardening this morning. If you want to join in the chat or send us a text message, the numbers are 94190155. Please call in and chat to us so we know there's someone out there. The text line, which usually goes off these days, is 0488 809 855. We will share some images of the plants that we eventually get to today on our social media pages. We're 3CR Gardening Show on Facebook and Instagram. And if you have, particularly for the podcast listeners, g'day to you all. If you have any questions and you want to send some photos to us, the best way to do that is to pop it into an email. And our address is 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. So I'm going to get on to some community announcements. There's a little bit going on at the moment, which is really cool. Running at the moment through till Sunday the 2nd of August, so we're getting into the latter part of it, is the Lightscape exhibition at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne. The tickets are $32 to $46, depending on the type of ticket you get. It has become a wildly popular winter event for people to get out and see. It's happening at Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne. It's an award-winning immersive light experience with a huge collection of new installations this year. It's different every year, running from Wednesdays to Sundays. You can get tickets from the visitor centre at the Botanic Gardens at the Birdwood Avenue entrance. but you can also buy them on Ticketek if you just type in Lightscape into the search engine. Coming up on Saturday the 1st and Sunday the 2nd of August is the Heritage Fruit Society annual fruit tree grafting and tree sales days. This is happening at a couple of locations, at Ceres in Brunswick on the Saturday the 1st of August, from 10 until 12. On Sunday the 2nd of August, it's 9 until 1 at Petty's Orchard in Templestowe. It's free to attend. They've got grafting demonstrations of heritage apples, plums, apricots, and a heap more. And there's tree sales on the day with scion and rootstock material that you can buy. So if you want to get some heritage fruit trees, this is a place to go. More information can be found at theheritagefruitsociety.org.au. Also, the week after, if you're on the other side of town, we have the Werribee Park Heritage Orchard is having their annual fruit tree and scion sales festival. So this is Sunday the 9th of August from 10 until 3 at Werribee Park Mansion, just down on the plains right near the Werribee River. It's a beautiful spot where that orchard is. So they've got sales as well, tastings, demonstrations, and there's a few exhibitors where you can get hold of some of these fruit trees. So the 1st and 2nd of August is the Heritage Fruit Society at Ceres and Petty's Orchard. And then Sunday the 9th is the Heritage Fruit Tree Festival at Werribee Park. If you Google Heritage Fruit Tree Festivals, you will find information for both of those. Moving on to the 28th to the 30th of August is the Orchid Society's Council of Victoria show, annual show, at Boxhall Pavilion, KCC Park on Western Port Highway in Skye. The show has got $10 entry. It's a massive, it's become even bigger in the last few years, I think, particularly since COVID, people become really interested again in these sorts of plants. It's open to the public. They've got an incredible display and diversity of orchids. You can learn all about growing them, speak to experienced growers and seasoned collectors who do this as a hobby and as a business. So that's the Orchid Society's Council of Victoria show at Boxhall Pavilion, KCC Park, Western Port Highway, on the 28th to the 30th of August. Adrian, I know you'll have this next one in your diary. Saturday the 12th and 13th of September is the Australian Plants
Expo. Yes, already in there.
hosted by the Australian Plant Society Yarra Yarra Group. It runs from 9.30 till 3 on the 12th and 9.30 till 2 on the 13th at Eltham Community and Reception Centre, 801 Main Road, Eltham. It's only $5 for adults, $4 for concession, and kids are free. There's a huge range of native plants being sold. There's about seven or so different stalls, grafted plants, uncommon species, indigenous plants. They usually have a big collection of books, crow's foot pottery, native flower displays, and there's activities for the kids available too. So it's a really big, beautiful, awesome Australian Plants Expo. So get along to that on the 12th and 13th of August. And the last one I'm going to reel off in detail is on Saturday the 19th of September is the Melbourne Clivia Group Expo from 10 until 3. Burwood East Uniting Church, $5 for adults, $4 for senior card holders. At this expo, they showcase rare and beautiful, very different flowering clivias. There'll be demonstrations on propagating and growing them too, and you can buy plants and seed at the show. That's Saturday the 19th of September. Coming up later in the year is the Angare Wildflower Show in September. And October has the Gippsland Rare and Unusual Plant Fair, and there's the Warringal Orchid Society show in October as well. So we're really kicking things off. If there's any gardening clubs or groups out there that want us to put their events into community announcements for the show, please send us an email at 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. And, you know, we'd love to really promote what's going on and keep that community spirit of gardening alive. The numbers, if anyone wants to join in the show, is 94190155. And the text line is 0488 809 855. Now, guys, when we were talking about today's show, it's saying, you know, it's Tree Day, and the question of what is your favourite tree is obviously going to come up. But because we're all massive plant nerds, coming up with one favourite tree was a little hard.
Very difficult.
So do you go, what's your favourite genus? What's your favourite family? And we landed on your top three favourite species.
And even then I bought an extra one.
Just cannot trust him with this stuff at all.
No, mate, I gave you some instructions and you can't even follow
You're very clear, Chloe.
I was walking around the garden and then I was like, no, you're coming too.
Do you want to kick us off? What's your top three?
Well, these are my top three for a small yard.
Okay, so it wasn't just in general. You had to really narrow it down to a
category. Yeah, well, like my favourite tree is Eucalyptus teratocornis and then the Gippsland subspecies. You're not growing that in your house. That's a huge tree.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So first one's Colitis oblonga, which is called the South Esk pine. There's three subspecies. There's the Tasmanian one, which is the most common one in cultivation. And there's another subspecies from the Tablelands in southern New South Wales. And then another subspecies from the North New England National Park area. This is an excellent screening tree slash
large
shrub.
I like the colour of it.
Yeah, beautiful slaty grey blue. And it grows into quite a dense small tree slash large shrub. It's in that borderline region between the two.
This was part of our conversation, actually. When is a tree and not a tree?
So the Australian standard, so Australian standard 4970, the protection of trees on development sites. Not that
also,
I know.
Also, I can't believe you know the
exact. Oh, do I know really that upsetting. Standard? Yeah. I refer to that standard 20 times a day. Under that standard, a tree is a woody perennial plant that's at least 3 meters high with one or few stems.
Okay.
So
3 meters. Yep.
3 meters is your entry point, and then you need one or few woody stems.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So bananas, no.
Yeah. Fleshy. That's fleshy. Yep.
Palm tree, sorry. They're just palms. They're not trees.
Under the standard, they are a tree.
They should not be. What about secondary thickening? You know, the woody tissue. See, this is where we're getting lost in the weeds, and we probably lost all the listeners now. But palm trees it's like tree ferns. They're not trees. Come on.
Anyway. But they live for more than 3 years, and they have a singular trunk.
And they're taller than 3 meters.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Across Melbourne, various councils assess palms. Some do, some don't. And it's often you'll find councils where they'll be quite palm heavy. They won't assess palms.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So down, I can't actually remember, but I suspect some of the more coastal councils, they're a little more lax about palms.
Yep.
Yep. Right.
Because it's Canary Islands everywhere.
Canary Islands. I mean, the poor buggers, though, they're in trouble in Melbourne. They're all getting fusarium fungus and dying. It's real sad.
Horrible. Okay, for anyone wondering what fusarium looks like, can you give us a on palm trees?
I actually haven't seen it in the flesh. I just know that it kills the palm tree. Actually, no, I have. So what happens is because palm trees only grow from one singular growth point, which is the top of the plant, that slowly declines and dies off.
Yeah.
To the untrained eye, you might look at it and think a bloody possum's up there ravaging the tree.
Yeah.
But, the top of the palm slowly dies, the fronds fall off, and then eventually the whole thing's dead.
Yeah. It kind of looks like it's melting.
Yeah. It's pretty sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some near Rod Laver Arena that look like that. Ooh. That look really – they've looked like that for ages. It's a slow death.
Yeah. It's not a fun way to go.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
No. Before we get on to some more plants, listeners, please text in or call in today if you want to froth about your favourite tree species to us.
And it could even be your favourite tree.
Or an individual.
We're kind of interested in, like, did you grow up with a tree? Did you plant something and you've gone back there 25 years later and it's doing its thing? Or, like, some of those cool tree stories. I think everyone's got a bit of a connection. Like, if you're a plant lover, you know.
Yeah. Did you sneak a tree into your first rental and it's still there and it's completely derailed a development?
So good.
That would be so good. Community service, that is.
Speaking of blue gums, just popped a few in the backyard.
All right, we've got it. We'll get to some of those your more plants in a second, Adrian.
Yeah,
there's a couple of text messages come through. David from Upway says he's really enjoying the native tree chat this morning and the weather chats. He's got a couple of staghorns that are just bare rooted. Any advice about mounting them? Where, what, and how? Thanks so much. Staghorn ferns.
So
thick fishing line, like 20-pound fishing line, and some coir or some moss.
Yeah,
So you any need sort that of board, really. Yeah.
So you can either you can mount them directly onto trees want to, which is kind of cool. You're just got to make sure they're on the south side, because they'll get hammered by north sun. So if you've got a tree that provides plenty of shade on the south side, you can mount them. You can either do that on the board, or you can mount them directly onto the tree.
Yeah.
So I think they look amazing when they actually kind of start growing off the tree themselves.
They do. When they get amazing when they get bigger and established. I'm thinking if anyone is renting or like maybe not staying in their house,
put them for on a long board time, for sure.
Put it on a board so you can take it with you.
Yeah, definitely.
But they'll need something at the back to keep it damp for them to sort of I don't know, get a bit of nutritional moisture off or something.
Yeah,
and usually just use thick fishing line to tie them on.
Yeah, or you
is
can.
Something a bit more gentle.
I mean, it depends. Like I've used material before and that sort of stuff. So. I think I used old pantyhose ones.
I knew you'd say something like that.
Yeah. They weren't mine for everyone listening at home.
Allegedly.
have to talk to my lawyer about that. But you can use anything really to mount it, as long as it's strong enough, you know. Yeah. It kind of depends on the size, because you get some big old girls. And, you know.
Especially with the staghorns. Oh, they can definitely. Oh, they're massive.
Yeah. They're pretty impressive.
They are.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Question. So I have one that's on a backing, and then I've nailed it onto my Norfolk Island pine.
Okay.
Is that going to stick to the tree eventually by itself?
I mean, potentially.
Eventually. It should. Yeah.
Cool.
Because they'll just they just put out a new leaf and it just like hugs over the next one.
Because every time I look at them, I can't understand how they suck onto anything. But it's the leaf structure that's sucking onto stuff.
Not so much the leaf,
Or is it there's the little roots?
Yeah,
I have no idea.
Like when you peel them off, you'll see the little structures that kind of can hold them on. Yeah,
fascinating.
Yeah,
they're pretty such cool ferns
because they're heavy.
Yeah, they're real heavy.
They really must latch on.
Yeah, definitely. Well, they have to support that weight. It's like some of the big orchids. You see, dendrobium on a rock.
Mm.
How is that there? And they've got these tiny little.
Yeah, definitely.
They're really.
Bird's nest ferns are another one as well.
True.
Yeah. When we were in Bali, there was these tiny little spindly palms, and then they had bird's nest ferns about 2 meters across, just hanging off the middle of this palm tree. How is that holding on?
All right, a couple more text messages have come in. Scroll down there. Doug from Altona North. I know this Doug. In his suburb, big four-wheel drives are more and more often parked on nature strips under street trees. It's my pet hate, so I dob them in via Snap Send Sold.
Oh my God, not Snap
beautiful
Send Sold.
Doug.
Yeah, that's
very
beautiful
nice
work, Doug.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
We love an illegal street parking.
Easy money for the council.
Yeah, I must admit I've done the same on my street. People park under our Lafostermans constantly. Yeah. And it's interesting, it does make an impact to the trees over time.
It definitely does.
Yeah.
There's one further down the road and someone's clearly parked on the nature strip for a bloody long time and the tree's half the size.
Mm. Yeah, right.
It does set them back.
Yeah. Well done, Doug. Community service right there.
Yep.
All right. There's another text message come in from Audrey. I bought a strawberry plant. an O-strawberry tree to plant in my backyard, back west Victorian paddock. But I think listening to you guys, I've made a mistake. What do you say?
No, I don't think you've made a mistake.
No?
No. So a strawberry tree, Arbutus euden.
Mm. Yeah.
Unido. Unido.
Mm. Yeah.
It's fine. That'll be a nice little paddock tree. It's contextual as well. Like,
can they
are
be
you
a
in
bit weedy though? Some of the arbutus.
Allegedly, yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently, but I mean, if you're in like, when I think Western Victoria, I think rolling grassy paddocks.
Yeah.
I'm not picturing you near remnant bushland. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's contextual. If you're right next to high quality remnant bush, it may not be the best tree to plant. But if you've got just rolling hills, great choice.
Cool.
Give your cows and goats something to hang out underneath.
Yeah, they do provide beautiful shade.
Mm.
I love the bark of the strawberry trees.
I was about to say that. The bark is out of control.
It's gorgeous, so beautiful.
Yeah. Like when you get the rain on it, it goes like that pinky red. And they're pretty nice trees. Yeah.
Good flowers too. Cute little flowers.
Oh, yeah. Super cute flowers.
I mean, even the foliage, like it's really dark green and like it is a good tree.
It's
and
got the little serrations on the foliage too. Yeah. I like that.
There's one there. I'm in Cheltenham, so kind of southeast, you know, grey sandy country, and there's one with a huge lignotuber tuber in Cheltenham Park. It's beautiful.
Cool.
So cool. I've always wondered if people kind of cut them back to multi-trunk them like you would a eucalypt or not, but I haven't grown any of them, so I wouldn't know. Mm.
Stephen Ryan would be the person to ask about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the arbutus unido, which apparently means inedible.
Oh.
Yeah.
The fruit do look tempting.
They do.
And they call it a strawberry tree. Yes. Like, yeah. If you didn't know better.
I know.
Yeah.
But I think it's a pretty sour strawberry if you do eat it.
Mm.
There's heaps of really cool hybrids and other sorts of species.
The Californian complex of manzanitas, they're stunning.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And a very important part of the ecology over there.
Mm.
That's been displaced by our eucalypts.
Sorry.
Whoops, sorry, God.
Yeah. Sorry, not I mean, sorry.
Definitely sorry.
We didn't exchange. We got Pinus radiata, so.
Mm.
Yeah, which is wild because that's like a critically rare tree over there found on one scabby little island.
Yeah.
Do you know this was always the argument. So in my past life when I worked for the Botanic Gardens, we were looking at bringing rare plants into cultivation. And people go, oh, well, you can't do that because they're rare and they can't grow. And that was always my pin-up, like Pinus radiata. Like, this is super rare in the wild.
Yeah.
Like, it's not about things that you can't grow. It's about, like, the context ecologically where these things are occurring. So, you know, they've done well everywhere. Mm-hmm. So as soon as someone said that, I just rebut with the Pinus radiata.
Yeah.
Like, in England, there's a good example of they grow a lot of alpine and subalpine eucalypts really well.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them don't do well in Australia.
Yep.
Yeah, like you'll definitely go to Kew Gardens and I remember walking through and it's the first time I ever saw an Romeo gum and it was massive.
Mm.
It was like 170 years old.
Really?
First one I've ever seen.
Neglecta, the Romeo gum?
There's a good one at Cranny.
Love that one so much.
Mm. Mm. Beautiful tree.
Yes.
But again, not
they're,
super
they're
easy.
Odd in the wild. Like they all look a little bit, they've still got that weird habit, you know, that kind of squat, kind of scrambly sort of habit, like almost tumble down a bit.
Mm.
But a lot of them don't look that good out there. And you go out there because it's near Buffalo and you've just got cows grazing and doing their thing and you're like, mate, we've got to protect these a bit better, surely.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
That one's a bit of an unknown one, neglector.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's, well, it's neglected.
I saw where you were going early with that. That's good stuff from
Thanks for letting me get it out.
Though. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I really enjoyed it. You're on fire on Sunday morning.
You know it. It's that cup of tea I had earlier. Yeah. All right, back to top three favourite trees. Your turn, Russ.
I mean, like it has to be a eucalypt. Mm. And I think... without going down the mallee path, I'd say like a good river peppermint in the wild, like a big Eucalyptus alata with the kind of weeping foliage and that kind of basal stocking and then that white trunk.
What's basal stocking?
So just like this kind of bark, maybe, you know, an eighth of the way up the trunk. So you get this kind of like peely sort of bark that just always is at the bottom of these beautiful river peppermints.
And it's a darker, it's not a dark brown, it's an almost black on
you
the rivers.
You can get some really black ones. Yeah. And that contrast with like the white trunk is, oh, beautiful.
Because the ironbark cider oxalans are a favourite. It's on my top three list. But yeah, love the black trunks of those. It's just stunning. But they're very deep. Whereas the elater, I think the fissures in it aren't as deep.
Yeah, and they kind of peel a little bit sometimes. And the foliage
is finer too and greener. Is
that right? Fine. Slightly weeping.
Yeah.
They're a highly ornamental tree.
And they're super long as well. So some of the foliage.
Do you want to tell you a little story about the elaters that you've found and worked on in the last few years?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I could. I chased, full disclosure, this is just, you know, my personal bias, Eucalyptus elater, because I've been chasing it for a decade. But I collected them all the way from the Avon River and the Glen Maggie region up to Wallamai National Park. So that's their kind of natural range. So I spent probably 5 years collecting from, I don't know, 40
that's amazing.
Populations. Yeah, doing some population genetics work on them. So I just fell in love with them, you know. Mm. And you can get these huge, like, trees by the river, you know, but you can also get them at elevation. So there's places like Mount Wadwalk and, you know, these ranges where they're maybe 3 metres tall and multi-trunked and, you know, just because of the exposure. And down on the Avon River, there's a tree called Eucalyptus ornans, which is basically a river peppermint. But where the flood line is, all of these things are like multi-trunk mallees. So they're like these perfect little trees. They're beautiful.
I was going to ask, there is a eucalypt cultivar called Dry White, and I've been sniffing around it for potential use at work.
Mm.
When I looked it up on PlantMark, it was listed as Eucalyptus ornans.
Yeah, and that's not correct.
So it is a elater.
As far as I know, the Dry White, so, well, this is... this is a very interesting question because there's three, like genetically, there's a cluster of three populations. So the Avon, Glen Maggie, and then up on kind of the McAllister River.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, the McAllister River one is Dry White. So I think it was collected by Bill Molyneux, possibly back in the day, and introduced into cultivation.
It's an Ostraflora label.
Yeah, I was going to say it's Ostraflora.
Yeah,
so they recently popped up on my radar, and I was like, oh, hello.
Yeah, So it's in that kind of cluster, but it's not from the Avon proper. It's from, the slopes above the McAllister River.
Which would explain the dwarf height.
Yes.
Because it's going to be dry.
Yep, and rocky.
Yep.
And can't hold heaps of moisture up there.
Same habitat as Gardenia macmillaniana?
Macmillaniana is further down the slope, so closer to the...
Sorry, I'm from Gippsland and river. I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, so we collected that too. So some of the different flower colours on Gardenia macmillaniana is crazy, and there's big flower. Anyway, I'm on a tangent, but but there's Tricarpa up there as well the dry white.
So do you reckon it would stay true to being a smaller uke, dry white?
No, so we grow them at Cranbourne.
Did it not
all
stay
of the
small?
Different ones, and they look like, you know, it's environmental predominantly. So this is the cool thing about cultivating these things, because you actually never know. So there's things that you bring down, like, you know, what's a good example? Eucalyptus varicata from the Grampians, which is on the top of Mount Abrupt. You bring it down, it maintains that little mushroomy habit and only gets to 2.5 metres or whatever. And then a plant that co-occurs with it, Elatocaulis, or people who call it Cypelicarpa, that's only... you know, probably 5 metres at the very top of its kind of elevation, you bring it down, it just turns into a massive tree.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
You know, you never know if it's genetically fixed or it's environmental until you put it in your garden and see what's happening.
Yeah.
So
that's good to know about the dry white, because I was about to use it under power lines. Not anymore.
Yeah. I
Because that's a huge problem as a arborist working to plant street trees.
Mm-hmm.
You get told from all sorts of things from nurseries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like Melia rosettorac is a great example. We've all been told that they're like the perfect street tree when they all were rolled out. And they're like one of our top complaint trees.
I'm sorry. How did that get through all the criteria and council red tape to be a street tree? Because, okay, it's a lovely tree. Nice flowers, decorative fruit. But I almost roll an ankle every time I walk over the fruit because they're planted on my street.
Yeah.
And the foliage makes a mess. Yeah. They're a great habitat tree because the cockatoos just rip them to shreds.
Also, they're prone to root rot.
Oh, great.
So when you need to fix the footpath, if there's big structural roots, you can't cut them.
How did that?
That's interesting because a lot of them are grafted, aren't they? Too these days.
The ones where I work aren't. They're okay. All just merely resetarac.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they're a bloody difficult tree, which is a shame because, like, some of the avenues of the mature ones now, they look really nice, but the maintenance, it's also a resourcing thing. Like, if you had unlimited resources, go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a good example. There was a massive one on Gertrude Street that collapsed into the middle of the road without warning.
Oh, God.
Yep. They rot out from the centre. You can't tell.
Oh, no.
I know.
Yeah. I want to ask you about tree maintenance and pruning in a second. But of course. John from Bond Beach has messaged in. one of my favourite trees is the wonderful red gum in a paddock in Carrum Downs. Nice. It fell over years and years ago, and it continued to grow sideways from the trunk with multiple new upright trunks.
I know the one. Do I you? Think it's on Thompson's cool. Road.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And that in the old days was all that red gum woodland. And I used to drive to work along Thompson's Road, like going to Cranbourne. And we should probably out John, who used to be the manager of horticulture at Cranbourne.
I wasn't going to out him, but you can.
Yeah, no, I've definitely outed him. And good to hear him talking about eucalypts. He used to just talk about rainforest trees. So he's obviously evolving as a human, yeah, which nice, is great. Yeah, yeah. But you would see that tree, like, in the the sun would be coming up, and sometimes it'd be all misty and like,
misty tree there.
Mate, it's a beautiful little tree.
Yep.
Yeah,
yeah.
It kind of highlights how resilient our yukis are to me. You know,
very.
Like, yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah,
and there's some incredible trees along there, like from Brayside all the way out to Cranny, like those old historic kind of wetlands and stuff. There's some interesting reserves and things.
Well, even up, I mean, they're all that land is being ripped up for residential housing now, and in the southeast, but up in the north around Doreen and up to Whittlesea, similarly massive paddocks with those beautiful huge red gums growing through them. A lot of them have been retained, those old paddock trees.
Yeah. Hume City Council has done an excellent job.
They have
like a whole internal policy and strategy for their retention and maintenance.
Amazing.
Do they? Oh, I'm so pleased to hear that.
They do a really, really, really good job.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Props to them. Yeah, because I remember before that all started to develop, we used to drive through there to get to the Hume, through Donnybrook and all that, to get to the Hume Freeway. And I just used to love driving through there.
Mm.
Sorry, correction. Whittlesea.
Not Whittlesea Council. Yeah.
Probably both.
Yeah.
Same problem.
Hopefully, yeah. Yeah, it would be. It's a pretty big area that's been developed.
Yep.
And it was just, you know, beautiful paddocks. And
yeah, they're magnificent.
Massive. I mean, they're well and truly predate European settlement.
Yeah.
And I think those trees we really need to work hard to protect.
Yep.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And if you go up to, you know, Barmer, then you see the real old girls and boys
I'll
up there.
I'll get there one day.
You know, they're like, have you never been to Barmer?
No.
You have to go.
Yeah,
right. You should go.
Yeah.
Someone I've been working with is a woman from Yorta Yorta country. So Barmer is like her, you know,
country.
Her go-to. And she's going to take me in the next couple of months and I'll give you a yell.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. But these reddies are like branched to the ground.
Oh.
And I reckon they'd be 1,000 years old, some of these things.
That's
like, they're
so cool.
Enormous. It's actually the only place I ever got lost in because it's just red gum country and it looks the same.
Yeah, it does.
And I got back like in the dark, and that was before the day of GPS, which you two youngsters probably wouldn't remember. But I thought I was going to die out there, but I made it. So that and if I was going to, that's probably a nice place to do it.
Yeah. You know what I think about those gums that grow in those floodplain areas like the Barmer Forest and even the ukes growing along the Yarra through like Bulleen, Templestowe.
Mm-hmm.
We don't – that's those sort of flooding events, particularly Yarra. We don't let the Yarra flood anymore. Mm. Like, Adrian, what's your take on – like we're talking about the ginger syndrome before – long-term changes, ups and downs in rainfall and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the effect that is having on those sorts of trees where flooding doesn't occur? I mean, whether it was every 5 years or every 20 years, it's not really happening anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you see decline. You see fairly substantial decline. You see whole sections of dead forest where they don't let it flood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's bad.
Yeah.
Mm. Rivers are meant to flood.
I know, especially in Australia.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, anywhere. Mm. Yeah.
Globally, it's the moment you start constraining a river, you see ecological collapse.
Yeah.
It's repeated everywhere across the road. World.
Do you know of anywhere that lets their rivers flood and there's
There's still wild there? Rivers in the world, but it's about how you live. And it's also like the hydrology of the river itself. Like some rivers are just inherently destructive, like the Yangtze River or the Hawkesbury River. Like the way that they flood is really suddenly a massive, disastrous flooding events,
right,
which wipe out large areas. And then that creates a specific sort of ecology that responds to it.
Mm.
So, you know, like the Yangtze's destroyed.
Mm.
The Hawkesbury's touch and go.
Yeah.
In Sydney, like when that floods, it's a huge disaster nearly every single time. And we're clearly not learning our lessons.
Yeah.
And I think it's that codependency with what we're growing, like agriculture and horticulture and that sort of stuff. Like
yeah, we about grow floodplain plants,
Murray Darling and that sort of stuff. You know, the floodplains are probably most of that excess water is taken to grow crops, which we all eat, you know. So there's always that balance between, you know, environment and production and, you know, even peri-urban, like where they're developing and all of that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's a tricky one, definitely, because those communities need that water.
Mm.
I actually think there's probably opportunities in even urban environments. Like I used to work as in the natural resource team at City of Kingston, actually, years ago. That's a long time ago now. But the where they've kind of redirected some of that floodplain water into these flood mitigation areas, I reckon that those are the areas that we have opportunities to do some of this kind of re-veg work and connectivity. So you could connect Mordialloc Creek to Edith Vale Seaford Wetlands.
Yeah. Yes.
And that sort of thing, you know, where you could really build something amazing. And there should be more money for that kind of redevelopment, for want of a better term.
Yeah, you know? That's what I'm thinking. Like, yeah, is there a way that we can let these rivers flood in some way that doesn't destroy people's homes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And there's so many people, like so many really smart people out there modelling and all of that sort of stuff. So the short answer is yes. Mm. It's just about political will and where the money goes and all that sort of stuff. So yeah.
It'd be interesting to go to some of the places that are really badly flood affected in Australia, like Brisbane and Lismore,
mm-hmm.
and see what learnings they have had as communities and what initiatives they've put into place.
Mm.
Is it rezoning? Is it structural flooding where they allow areas to flood like we're talking about? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because there's a huge incentive for them to do it, particularly somewhere like Lismore. The whole community was catastrophically destroyed.
Yeah, like twice.
Twice, yeah.
In the last few years.
And it's not even like, you know, some people's houses that haven't been a write-off. Like they're filled with mould and they basically need a full reno.
Mm. Mm.
That'd be heartbreaking.
Yeah. I think in Melbourne we are going to have to start looking to northern New South Wales and, you know, Brisbane or southeast Queensland if we are going to start getting these wetter summers with really heavy amounts of rain coming in shorter periods of time. I had friends from Queensland down. You know, December in Melbourne can be really stormy and hot and humid.
Yes.
And we get a lot of rainfall. Just in that month, it's really strange. But I had friends from Queensland down then, and everyone in Melbourne was going into a panic because we were forecasted to get 80 to 100 mil in one day. And they were like, that's standard practice for us. Like, you guys are piss weak. Hard enough. And, you know, they were saying their infrastructure is different. Their stormwater pipes, like suburban stormwater pipes, are twice the size of what our regular stormwater pipes are. And our infrastructure just can't take it. So from that perspective, you know, and environmentally, we should be looking at how they do it in a lot of ways.
Mm.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, that's a huge thing at work is every time we get more than 20 mils of rain, somewhere floods.
Yes.
Without fail.
Like 20 mils, I mean, 20 mils is awesome, but it's not catastrophic. Like, shouldn't be catastrophic.
It stops traffic.
Yeah, it does.
Trains get cancelled.
Yes.
Melbourne comes to a standstill.
Yeah.
And then there'll be a meme and it's like a plastic chair and a backyard thrown on the ground. It's like, we will rebuild.
I love that meme so much.
It's like when we get earthquakes, it's like, oh no.
Yeah. All right. Someone sent in another text message. Susie has asked for some street tree suggestions for planting under power lines, deciduous and evergreen.
Great question. Mm. That is my bread and butter at work.
Can I have one suggestion? I bought in a Tristenopsis laurina, which I've got on my at my place at home.
Yeah.
I've just had one planted on my nature strip. They got in before I was going to put something in, and they put in this, like, I mean, it's a beautiful little tree, so I'm not complaining, but I was going to do some gorilla planting. I think, Adrian, I think this is...
Shout out to the local council in Chloe's area.
I mean,
I can just imagine you swoop in, and then, like, this happens at work all the time. People will rip the tree out and then replant their own tree, but then, like, put the stakes and everything back perfectly.
Yeah, I did that.
So it looks like you can't tell, and it's like, I can tell the difference.
Yeah, yeah. That's never been on our planting list.
Yeah.
I put in
Where did this rare West Australian eucalypt come from?
That's what I did. I put in a Eucalyptus erythronema. It's a WA one that's supposedly good in clay soils.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it got fried on one of our 45-degree days. And I let it sit there hoping it might reshoot. It was not established enough to reshoot.
Mm-hmm.
And I cut it off at the base, and literally a week later, the council came in and planted this little Tristenopsis.
Mm.
I couldn't believe it. I was like, are you guys watching me?
Yeah. There was a stakeout across the road. They were eating donuts, just waiting for you.
They set up wildlife cameras to monitor your behaviour.
Yes.
And the moment they saw regrowth, they were like, right, let's act. Let's really crush us.
The alarm goes off. Yeah.
But this is a good, I'm pretty sure this is, or I hope this is a dwarf form, like luscious.
No.
No?
No, that is just straight Tristy, which isn't a bad thing. I would say the straight Tristy is better in some ways because you get better genetic diversity.
Okay.
It's also a little bit more drought tolerance. Mm-hmm. We've been having quite a bit of issue with them at work. They've been 50% success rate.
Okay.
And that's an establishment phase thing. Yep. So luscious is a really great option if you can establish it. But if you, not, yeah. The type species, Lorena, just standard Lorena, it can be a better bet. There's some good examples on Wellington Street.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like 30 years old. The other great thing about Tristies is they will grow to the size of the area they're in.
Right.
So if it's a confined growing space, they won't just explode out all over the place.
Okay.
Their root system isn't as aggressive as some of the other trees
you've got. Yeah, they're quite compliant.
Yeah, Tristies are a fantastic choice.
I was quite happy. I came home from work one day and I was like, bang, there's a tree in my nature strip.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah, Tristy's a good choice. Yeah.
And there's what the neighbours, like my next door neighbours have one a few years older on theirs, and it's got a nice habit.
They'll do really well at in your area. And in terms of a climate match moving forwards with climate change, good choice.
Oh, cool. But do you reckon water it during summer if they can be a little bit sensitive?
Yeah.
In establishment.
Yeah, I think it's probably worth noting that they're warm temp rainforest trees.
Yeah.
You know, so like in the wild, like they predominantly live on riversides. They call them like gallery rainforests or whatever. It's interesting. It's one of those trees that, you know, you would probably think wouldn't suit a different climate
because
you
need
high rainfall and all that sort of stuff. But they seem to be pretty resilient far. But there's a bunch of different forms of them as well. So you can get them. I think they start around kind of now an hour, and they're kind of dwarf and they're really super narrow. Like they're almost linear, like they're tiny leaves. And then you go to some of the rainforest proper and they're huge things.
Yeah.
Like you couldn't get four people to wrap your arms around them, you know.
Because wasn't it Tristenopsis used at Cranbourne as a replacement because there were some other eucalypts that didn't grow, but the Tristenopsis were, am I thinking of something else?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe. It could have been before my time, though.
It might have been before
your time. Because they're definitely down by the kind of Riverwalk area.
Yeah, I reckon there was something else put there.
Yeah, okay.
And they didn't work, and they put down the water gums because they were just...
Yeah, because it's so wet in there.
So wet.
Like underneath. Yeah. So that makes sense. There'd be a lot of yukis that wouldn't like it down there, for sure. Yeah.
Just with the Tristies as well, there's a really interesting population on the Buchan River. The Buchan River.
Yeah.
Gets frosts, and they regrow from rootstock.
Oh, okay.
So they're not fire tolerant. Well, they are fire tolerant. They're lignotuber.
So you wouldn't want to knock it with the mower if you're doing a rough mowing job in your nature strip.
Don't whip a snip around the base of them. That is a good point.
Yep.
Yep.
That's a good point for most trees as well.
Yeah, definitely.
It is insane that we're still doing that stuff.
Yeah, like put some mulch around the base of the trunk so that it doesn't get damaged.
Shout out to anyone growing crepe myrtles on your nature strip.
Yes.
Do not go near it with a whippersnapper because you will kill it.
Mm.
They have a very thin bark. Yep. That's the main reason we lose them at work. People ring bark.
Maybe we could start a vigilante group and just tackle people who are whippersnipping, you know.
Whippersnip them. That's the punishment.
Yeah, true.
Like, some councils use these special little like tube things around them to stop the whippersnippers.
Clip them around sort of. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Yep. Yeah. All right, we're going to continue with the plan chat, but we have a special patient listener on the line. Alex, good morning.
Good morning, Chloe. How are you going?
Good, thanks. Thank you for waiting while we got this Tristinopsis chat out of our system.
That's all good. I completely forgot that I was on hold.
That's good.
There's an insight into how long Chloe's made you wait, mate.
Yeah. Alex, I've asked you to call in today because you have been involved in getting or resurrecting the Australian Plant Society's Melbourne City Group.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yes, that is correct. So the Melbourne District Group was actually the first when the PS was founded in, I think it was 1957.
Yep.
That's where it happened. And at some point, and I'm not kind of quite sure exactly why, the group went dormant in the 80s or the 90s. And, a few of us have been kind of brainstorming about getting it up and running. And then, last year at a conference, I was chatting to Robin Tyson, who's the current APSV president. And she was like, I've been thinking about reviving the Melbourne group. And I'm like, oh, really? Because that's exactly why I wanted to talk to you today. I guess a year later, and it's begun. We had a meeting a couple months ago, and I expected there to be like 5 to 10 people just to kind of, plan of attack type conversation. And there are actually like 40 people there.
Oh, amazing.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you. And, we've had to move venues a couple of times to accommodate the interest.
That's a good problem to have early, isn't it?
Definitely.
It is.
You're just reaching capacity and you've got to move up. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Alex, are you planning for the group to operate similarly to how other APS groups do, operate with, monthly meetings somewhere and some garden visits and other activities across the year?
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's like it's a pretty good model.
Yep.
I'm a member of the Killer Plains branch, which is an excellent branch.
They're such a good
shout out
group.
To those guys.
Yeah. Big shout out to
you
them.
Guys mentioned Trevor Blake earlier. Trevor's a regular at our
legend.
Oh.
Yeah.
He is a legend. He's one of the funniest people I've ever met.
He is so funny and so cheeky.
He is. the model, I guess, for me, it's a really good model. It's tried and tested. It's been like almost 7 decades of this society kind of, you were talking about the Victorian horticulture mafia. I think a large portion of those have been strongly connected with
definitely
APS.
Yeah.
And so I think it works, and it's kind of churned away for, I guess, a long time now. But I think the membership's kind of aging a little bit, if we're going to be honest about it. And we're really passionate. Those of us who are a little bit younger, I mean, I'm pushing 50, so I'm not super young. But
you're a baby at
really
APS, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do notice that when I go to one of the sales.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And, there's a huge groundswell of young people, and not just young people, but people with all ages who are kind of increasingly concerned about nature, our local spots, caring about, like, motivated to do that kind of thing. And, you see it in bird watching and other kind of various natural interest things. Birding is having a moment. We really want plant sickos to have a moment.
Yeah.
We
deserve it.
Yeah, we deserve it.
Exactly.
Oh, go on.
No, you go, Chloe.
Oh, there's a lot of people in a city that are really getting into particularly Indigenous plants, But Australian plants, there is growing interest in it, and it's not because I'm biased. I was talking to A.B. Bishop about it recently, who's the Hort editor of Gardening Australia magazine. She goes, the amount of questions we're getting about growing, like that niche stuff of growing Australian plants is absolutely increasing these days.
Because you get that duality of opportunity. Well, triality, I suppose, if that's a word. Because you can grow rare Australian native plants, help out with conservation, you can contribute to local biodiversity, and you can have a nice garden.
Yeah. Amen.
Exactly.
Bam.
So, Alex, how can people find out information about the Melbourne group? Have you got any web pages or social media pages going yet?
Look, it's mostly because we're still kind of like we're sitting under the auspice of the APS Vic at the moment, like until we kind of become formalised, which would probably happen at the next meeting.
Yeah.
We're still if you want to know about what we're doing, just in the next kind of few weeks, go to the APS Vic Facebook page or the Instagram or the website, I guess.
Yeah.
All those things are kind of, you know, we've got a very enthusiastic and large working group of people who are
awesome.
Really excited about making this work. And the we'll be on the socials very soon.
Cool. And meeting speakers or garden visits, can you, you know, dangle some carrots for people about what you guys are planning in the next few months or so?
Oh, we do have, I mean, I can speak to the next meeting. Wednesday the 5th of August, Jean McKendry Neighbourhood Centre, which is our first time there in North Melbourne. We're going to have Mel from Brunswick Communities for Nature. Mel is... I guess a linchpin of inner North Melbourne's kind of guerrilla / anarchist gardening movement.
Yes.
Growing cheap local plants
yep.
for the community to chuck in their nature strip or, you know, go a bit rogue at various spots. So Mel is, to me, like a really good one to have, like our first non-APS member speaker. That's the next one. I can't kind of reveal anything yet because we haven't locked anything in yet, but there will be a number of speakers who are kind of, you know, significant, in, you know, conservation, ecology.
That's a great character.
Horticulture.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some great trips. You know, I'm trying to organise something, our first trip to be up to Nillumbik, Hanson Hill Bushland Reserves, you know, all the orchids are going off there. So that's kind of the most exciting thing in the short term, I think. Yeah.
Yep.
I think one of the great things about the APS is, and I have this conversation a lot with people, and we even had this chat this morning, Chloe, about how there's less and less opportunity to get plants from nurseries. Like there's a couple of specialist native nurseries, but like you were saying before, you know, the mafia of Australian plant growers probably aren't, you know, we don't have the same kind of depth of knowledge, I don't think, and depth of species in the nursery trade. And what you can do at the APS is join, you know, a group from a region, but there's also, you know, the Grevillea study group or the acacia study group or whatever it may be, and you can get access to plants and you all start growing things together and swapping them. And, you know, it's another way of kind of getting plants into the mainstream, which is fantastic.
Yeah. And conserving cultivars really and species too.
Just on that, Russell, we've got several staff from both Billy and Vink involved in the group already.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
Great stuff.
We want to be quite parochial about Melbourne and Victorian plants. You know, I think all those WA plants have had their time in the sun.
Oh, mate. You are speaking my language,
Russell,
my friend.
Absolutely buzzing from that sentence.
Yeah. I think we need to be best friends. I'm just saying. We had
I pinched that from you, Rob.
Because we had that at Cranbourne. You know, we wanted to be the King's Park of Victoria, not the King's Park of WA. Exactly. You know,
yeah.
Alex, that's absolutely awesome. Before I let you go, can you just give our listeners a little plug on the business that you run, Folly Landscapes, please?
Oh my goodness! Oh, you're so kind, Chloe. Thank you so much. Yes.
Give us a rundown of what you and Matt do.
Yeah, so Matt and I, who are both former students of Chloe, We have a landscape design, construction and gardening business, garden maintenance business, mostly around the inner Melbourne area, I guess. We're both real native and local plant enthusiasts.
Beautiful.
And, so we love to do that, bring that local ecology into people's gardens and, build a garden. And build a garden not just for the person, but not just to make a nice space, but also to encourage them to get into that space and so they can take over and really get passionate about it. Yeah. And planting for nature, the bugs and the birds, et cetera, that are from that local area.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's good.
And there should be more of that.
I know.
You know, it's so good to hear people doing, especially the local stuff, like Melbourne and Greater Melbourne, we're flush with incredible species that are good garden plants. So,
so many.
Yeah. Good on you.
Alex, thank you for calling in today. Thanks for all the efforts you've been putting in to get this Melbourne APS group up and running again. And it sounds like you've got some good people involved, and it's gonna be good. You'll be right. You'll be set.
It's amazing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, you guys.
That's
and
right.
Thank you for a great show this morning.
It's here to amazing. Support it.
Thank
All
you.
Right, we'll speak to you soon. Cheers.
Wonderful. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
See ya.
I think they should push the line that they were the first. Definitely get some merch
for sure.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
You're a great APS group, but we were first or something. Maybe. That's a bit aggressive for APS, not sure. Anyway, we could have brainstormed that off air, possibly.
That's absolute waste of our time, the last 20 seconds. So it's Folly Landscapes, the business that Alex and Matt run. It's Folly Landscapes. Follow them on Instagram. They're doing some really beautiful gardens.
When was the first meeting? 5th of August? Or the next meeting?
The next meeting, Wednesday, the 5th of August, I think. It's the Wednesday, that first Wednesday in August.
Yeah, I might even see if I can get along.
Yeah.
Be interesting to see what they're doing.
It would be. I'm getting schooled by a listener. Hey, Chloe, pronunciation is Tristaniopsis, not Tristan. Love the show, though.
Correct.
So thank you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that. listener Chris Nicholson. Hello, Chris. Messaged in, he says he has Eucalyptus yarraensis in his front yard in Ferntree Gully.
Amazing.
I'm impressed.
Nice work.
Beautiful tree. He planted it as a tube and it's now 15 metres tall.
See, that's beautiful. That's the kind of stories that we want to hear.
It keeps going, mate. This gets
beautiful.
Better. He believes the seed was sourced from trees removed during the building of EastLink.
Which even is better.
Even better.
Mm.
We need to keep that in mind when we need seed. Unfortunately, a neighbour of his has moved in and removed almost all the trees in their yard, including a 50-year-old Alocasurina torulosa.
That's crazy.
On the western side, so he's already feeling the heat from summer.
That's rough.
I love Alocasurina torulosa.
Mm. It's a beautiful tree.
Oh, it's stunning. Yeah. Like the purple
when it gets tinge. That's what I was going to say, the purple and the red.
Yes.
And also in the wind. Akashi, they sound so good.
The whooshy sound.
Oh, the whooshy sound.
Whooshy is good. I've never been able to describe what it sounded like. That's amazing.
Yes.
And I also want to say Chris is an incredible Australian plants person as well. So I'm just outing everybody at the moment. But Chris used to work at the Australian Garden in Royal Park and bought some incredible species in there.
Yep.
And he's doing some amazing stuff at my local council, getting people to rethink how they design and plant and manage Australian plants. So he's one of the great allies and a very good plants person. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Shout out to Chris.
Yeah.
Listener Mike has messaged in, talking about biodiversity, there should be an extermination program for noisy miners in the burbs. I had 12 species of birds visiting. Now I have one.
Mm.
I agree.
Yes. So this is a question of ecology. So there's been quite a lot of work done on this. And when you have big trees and single trunk trees and lawn and no shrub cover.
Mm-hmm.
Noisy miner paradise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And Indian miners too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
So every time you modify a landscape, you have an impact somehow, the research suggests that if you start to build that mid-layer more, you'll get some of the smaller birds back. So they've got somewhere to hide and, they'll be able to kind of shelter from you know, noisy miners are the most aggressive birds on the planet. They're unbelievable. Oh, they're just relentless. So it gives them some shelter. And also if you're planting some of those things that, you know, like I love spinebills. I think they're the best. So, you know, corriers are a good one.
They love a corrier.
Absolutely love corriers and aeromophilas and, you know, wherever you are. I mean, there'll be some local species. But it really is a lot about that kind of mid-story. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And the typical park planting is lawns because they're easy to maintain and trees, native trees, and they usually hang out in eucalypts.
Yep.
Yep.
I remember I think we had Justin Buckley, who's the manager of the National Trust garden properties. He said they don't – in particular – I remember particularly saying at Rip and Lee, I think it was Justin who said this, they don't have issues with noisy miners and or Indian miners. Because of the way that's planting, but there's they're all exotic trees there and they just don't go for them.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Because they go after like nectar rich because they need sugar to be that aggressive.
Yeah.
They're like, mate, I need a sugar.
You need a lot of energy to really start harassing
some people.
I reckon you're a noisy miner in a past life,
100%. Yeah. I see a little bit of myself in them, you know, so I don't hate on them as much. I'm like, you're
maybe not a noisy miner. Maybe like a large honey eater of some sort.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Maybe a wattle bird. Yeah.
Still annoying. On that, yes, they are annoying and it would be nice to eradicate them, but we've kind of created it, but we can sort of work our way out of it by creating habitat that is not their ideal habitat.
Yep.
So get rid of your flipping lawn is the first thing I would say to people.
Mm.
And I'm not like aiming that at Mike, listener Mike.
No.
But if you've got lawn, get rid of it.
Em did a really great series of segments on Gardening Australia that you can still watch.
Yep.
So that would be a great starting point. She talks all about habitat creation in a garden.
Yes.
And that mid layer is the critical factor for small birds.
Yep.
You don't have it, there's no point.
Yep. We're talking about Emmeline Bowman. She has the links to those videos on her website, which is stemlandscape.com, I think. But they are also on YouTube.
Just hire her to design your garden. Oh, you know, another great option.
Yeah, great option.
Are we getting commission for this stuff from our
but I don't know about you.
I'll still pretty invoice.
I don't remember having that chat, but yeah, cool. The other thing I wanted to mention was, you know, Gardens for Wildlife are incredible. And they have, you know, this is bedded down in kind of research around, you know, predominantly kind of urban ecology and that sort of stuff. But there's a bunch of really active groups and they come out and they'll assess your garden and talk to you about, you know, what do you want to attract to your garden and how you can do that. So that's probably a really great resource. And they're all over the place from City of Melbourne all the way out, a bunch of different councils and stuff. So.
Most councils are on board with and do have the Gardens for Wildlife collaboration.
Yeah.
Yep.
Not all of them do though, but usually the councils that aren't part of Gardens for Wildlife do have a similar program where you can get in contact with them. They'll come out, they'll do a garden consult with you.
Mm-hmm.
They'll send their horticulturalist out and they'll give you a report and some recommended species. Yep. And you usually get a voucher to get free plants from the local indigenous nursery as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So it's available. It's out there.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of resources as well that those councils provide. Yep. I'm just going to promote myself for a second, but I've been helping the City of Melbourne with the Urban Nature Planting Guide. So this is around a bunch of predominantly local kind of Melbourne species, how you can grow them horticulturally. But they have this incredible section where it's about, you know, what these species provide. So it might be a host plant for a butterfly or a food plant for a particular bird or whatever. So there's a bunch of resources out there if you want to design a garden to bring in small birds or you want butterflies or you want blue-banded bees, which I did. Mm. You know, you can find that information, kind of plant to it, which is cool.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like the little stickers and signs you can get for Gardens for Wildlife too. Like,
they're the best.
I really want one on my front.
Well, I want one too.
Want one on my fence.
My council isn't in the Gardens for Wildlife program, which is such a drainer. Oh, man.
You should harass them.
I really should.
Yeah.
But Invertebrates Australia have a really cute letterbox sign as well, and I bought that.
Nice.
And it's got really pretty butterflies and little birds and cute flowers on it. I would recommend that for you.
Ooh,
and
okay. I liquid nails it instead.
To my letterbox.
So good. Perfect.
Yeah, it's so cute.
You got to tell people that you're better than everybody else, I think, you know, with a nice sticker.
And you got to do it subtly, you know, just like that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know? Yeah, it's beautiful.
Smug and subtle.
Yeah.
All right. We've had a message come in from Peter and Vicky in Notting Hill. They have a 10-metre high lemon-scented gum. It's not had leaves for about 4 years. We think the possums have been smashing them. When they scratch the bark at the bottom, it shows that it's still alive. So their questions are, should they do nothing or would it be a good idea to cut it back? How much do you cut it back? You guys can see the message. Like, it does have a lignotuber and the lorikeets do love it. What's the go?
Okay.
They drop their leaves when they're stressed.
Yeah, there's probably a couple of things going on. There's my hunch would be that there is some sort of underlying stressor that the tree isn't loving. It could be that it had a girdling root. There might be some weirdness in the soil. There's probably something that's triggered it to not do well to start. Then the possums have moved in.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it sounds like the possums have now become the primary issue. So then what you want to do is, if you can, you need to isolate the canopy of the tree so the possums can't get in there.
Good luck.
Good luck doing that.
Yeah.
First step would be a big possum guard around it. Then the next thing would be to formatively prune back the canopy to remove competition from away from it. And then sea soil, mulch, good standard tree care. And only give it a year or two. And if there's no recovery, better to start again.
Yeah.
You've got to be a bit brutal with large eucalypts when they start to cack it.
Especially the smooth-barked ones.
Yeah, because there's also a risk that it could be root rot and the whole thing could topple over.
Yeah.
You don't want to mess with that.
So, look, probably worth getting an arborist in to do an assessment.
100%.
Yep.
So what you want to look for when you get an arborist is you want AQF level 5. So there's different levels of qualification within arborists.
Yep.
That's what you're after. You want
a diploma of arboriculture.
Yes, you're looking for that level of qualification. You're also looking for keywords like consulting arborist when you hire them. Ideally, you also don't want to be engaging with an arborist that works for a company that cuts the tree down at the same time.
Amen.
Because what they will do is promote cutting down the tree.
Amen.
And they're also not obviously going to probably look at important things like council overlays that protect the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get in a lot of trouble. So, yeah, get a good consulting arborist in as well to give you a detailed assessment of the tree, and they can probably give you more accurate guidance on what's going on.
Yeah. Yep.
But maybe a scratch around the base of the tree, see if there's any sort of fungal, if it's really wet, what's going on with your soil, is it really dry?
Mm.
Maybe it's become hydrophobic.
Yeah. I had a client of mine in Hawthorne had a really 70, 80-year-old lemon-scented gum.
Mm.
And it was losing its leaves. And what we reckon the issue was, there was an old pond in the house. These clients moved into the house and they got rid of the pond because it was very unsafe. And then we reckon the tree was just feeding off the water that was in the pond. Because the pond had been leaking.
Interesting. Mm.
And then it dropped all the leaves. So they started watering it. The recommendation was with sea soil. Fortnightly, or not necessarily sea soil. It's not as good as what it used to be, but a seaweed-based fertilizer, a liquid drench, sorry, and it started to grow back. But you definitely want to prune it to isolate the canopy to try to minimize the amount of possums that can jump into it too.
Yep. Yeah. And with any pruning work, there's an Australian standard, AS4373 or 4... Yeah, 4373. Pruning of amenity trees.
Check that at home, by the way, because this is incredible.
So that's your go-to standard for pruning trees. It lays out all the information that you need on how a tree should be pruned.
Yep.
And then in terms of getting an arborist to prune the tree, AQF level 3 or above.
So AQF 3 is certificate, would be a certificate 3 in arboriculture. It's more of the trade level, but for consulting stuff, you want the diploma or above. Qualification in arb.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But with your pruning of that canopy, don't remove any more than 10 to 20% in a time.
Yeah.
And then cutting back to branch unions. You want nice clean cuts. You want sterilized pruning equipment, particularly with a tree that's weak. You don't want to introduce a pathogen. What else? That'll do.
That's a good checklist.
Mm. Also, remove any deadwood while you're up there.
Yeah.
If the whole tree's declined, there's probably a few hangers hanging out in there.
Yeah. I mean, that's why it pays to get in, a consulting arborist every now and then to to do a prune. Like we would prune or deadhead our shrubs.
Oh, 100%.
Trees need the same thing.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a big issue that I run into at work, is that people assume that a tree is just an asset that's self-managing and they don't need to do anything. And the moment you need to invest any time or energy into it, it becomes a liability. Mm. It's like that's kind of a crazy attitude towards having a living thing.
That makes no sense.
Like every living thing needs input.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you don't plant a rose and then assume that it's fine.
Yeah.
Especially with a tree, like there's a hazard element to it that needs to be managed.
Yeah, absolutely.
But considering the value, especially environmentally,
of what
these trees do in these areas where we're losing trees by the day,
like
you're better off doing the best you can to retain that, because it's going to take you another 100 years to establish a similar tree. I was just going to say with possums, there's a bit of a quirk. Like once your tree gets hammered by possums, the new growth, so the tree produces this kind of sugary stuff, and it's like crack for possums.
Mm,
yeah, awesome so crack. That they'll continue to, you know, have a crack at that new growth. So isolating that is really important. I always feel like the possums have made it in suburbia. So I've got a real soft spot for ringies and brushies, and I'm like, good on you.
Apparently, ringtails are quite rare in the wild.
Ringies.
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know.
Apparently.
That.
Yeah. Well, they're protected under legislation. You can't a pot ringtails.
Actually, you're right.
Not that you're going to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
But brush tails, no, they're not protected to the same standard as a ringtail.
Yeah.
Mate, I've got an enormous brushie outside my house. It looks like a Labrador
beast.
On a wire. Honestly. I can't believe how big this boy is.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Well fed.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah, look, you got to give, and cockatoos I'd put in that group as well of animals that have worked out how to live in suburbia.
Yeah, definitely.
They've got it down pat.
You got to hand it to them. And the noisy and Indian miners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though they're very annoying.
Yep. Corellas, galahs.
Yeah.
They're all killing galahs. Magpies, touch and go.
Yeah.
Every now and then you'll see a healthy group of maggies.
Yep.
Like we've got our resident magpies near my place, but every year their chicks die. It's really sad.
Oh.
Run over.
I thought this was going to be a feel-good story.
Yeah. But
yeah. No, sorry, it's not.
Wow.
Turn? Yeah. I saw them nesting yesterday and they were flying along and they were carrying a bunch of plastic and I'm like, oh, fuck.
Oh, sorry, mate.
Yeah, whoops.
Yeah.
Hopefully the chicks will do well this year. Yeah, they will. They will.
But I think your point about isolating the tree once it's getting hammered by possums, and hopefully they can move to another one and that sort of stuff. But you should also take care when thinking about how you're doing that. Like it might be the only food source. And you're kind of balancing tree health too, making sure that these little dudes are still doing their thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes, definitely.
We've had a listener call in asking about the Royal Botanic Gardens tour that was originally set for today. They bought tickets during our Radiothon extravaganza. The date did have a last-minute change, and we do apologise for that, but the Royal Botanic Gardens tour is actually on the 6th of September, the morning of the 6th of September. So if anyone did buy tickets to that, we will get in contact with you, but it will be closer to the 6th of September date. And that little message has reminded me about Radiothon. There are still some places available for a couple of experiences and tours for Radiothon. So just get in contact with the station during business hours if you want to grab some of those tickets. You can go on the 3CR website as well, but give the station a call during the week. We've still got a spot left for the lacto-fermented hot sauce workshop on Sunday, the 1st of August. There's places available. And for the following tours, there's places available. So the tour of the Dandenong Ranges on the 16th of August, Melton Botanic Gardens, 13th of September. And then going into October and November, we've still got a few spots. They're selling up, but there's a few spots left for Heronswood Gardens in Dramana, Cloud Hill Gardens and Forest Glade Gardens. So, get in contact with the station 94198377. And if you want to book in for those, and I think we'll probably have a few, we'll let you guys know over the next couple of months if there are still some places available. But the RBG tour is on Sunday, the 6th of September. So, sorry for the mix up with that. All right, Russell, we've done one, and Adrian, we've done one favourite tree species, and I think we need to get through your three. Adrian, speed what round. Was your second one? Yeah, speed round.
We'll go super speedy. Yeah. Next one's Alocasurina grampianiana.
Nice.
Yep.
Yep.
So this is a Victorian endemic, as the species name suggests, only found in the Grampians.
Yeah, cool.
It is, I would argue, probably the most beautiful of all the casuarinas. It is blue-grey.
It's that glaucousy kind of foliage. And
stunning. Yeah, kind of, yeah. There's some really good examples at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne as you're walking around near the cafe area, I believe, on your way down to the cafe. It gets to about 5 metres tall, so this is in that sort of, is it a large shrub? Is it a tree? This is a really great option if you want a large feature shrub slash tree. Absolutely beautiful foliage. A little hard to come by, but I found it to be really easy to grow because the one at my place is not growing in optimal conditions. It's in full shade.
Just doing its thing.
Yeah, yeah. Just ticking along.
Amazing.
Hanging out under a massive buck and blue wattle that is not what I thought it was.
We talk about this tree of yours a lot. It's my favourite acacia. But they've got such like a messy habit.
It's 7 metres tall now. I need to cut it down. Oh, wow.
Yeah, do you know this hanging is the fastest growing acacia in the country?
Yeah, John told me that too. Yeah.
Really?
They are so fast.
Freaked me out.
Yeah.
It's growing so fast.
I had one in a pot for a few years and it went nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're incredible. And so they grow really, really fast.
And they die quick too.
Yeah, live fast, die fast a little bit in cultivation.
It'll be dead soon. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Fill me with hope.
Yeah.
It's going to crap itself and fall on the roof. Yeah. We'll get in a lot of trouble. So that's that one. Next one is
Can I just very quickly say that's one of the species that I'm working on at ARI, so we're doing bushfire recovery surveys of species that were hit by the fires, and Grampiana is one of those endemics that we're looking at.
Cool. Even my understanding is even within the Grampians, they're quite restricted in where they're found.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they're not a common tree.
Probably the hotspot is the Wonderland Range, kind of around that area.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I mean, cashews are really interesting because they look like conifers.
Mm.
But they have flowers.
You know, they're nitrogen fixing too.
There you go. Ooh. Yeah. And they'll have female plants and then male plants.
Yeah. So, cool. That's the other interesting thing about mine. So mine is male and it's got tiny little red flowers.
No, that's the girl.
Is that it?
The red's the girl and the orange is the boy.
Oh, I'm such a goose.
You are a goose.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
You've done well this morning. We'll let this one slide.
Oh, no, there's been a few whoopsies.
Well, we did pick it up on it.
No, that's fine. I did.
All right, Russ, what's your number two?
Oh, I don't know. Do you know, I was thinking...
Mate, we've got a couple of minutes. I know. Just get something out.
It's so hard. I think... Like, I was thinking about rainforest trees, you know, so probably, like, cool-temp rainforest, like Arthrosperma is pretty amazing.
So like, good.
Because it's a throwback to that kind of weird conical kind of pine tree habit.
Smells amazing in flower.
They're incredible things. And they, you know, we think about our landscapes probably dominated by the eucalypts a lot. But when you go into, like, a proper cool-temp rainforest, you know, and you see those Arthrospermas, they're pretty beautiful. So
stunning.
I'm going to throw that one up there. And one of the guys I work with at Cranbourne told me that, and I've never unseen it now, they have S-shaped branches to shed the snow.
Really?
So they've got all these little traits and quirks that help them deal with the cold back in the day. So, So next time you see one. Yeah. You know, up in the Dandy Ranges or whatever, have a look at their branches and you'll never unsee it.
I've got one in a pot, but I'll have a closer look at it.
Yeah.
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 Right. I need to get another one for a pot as well because they're so slow growing. It works well as a pot plant.
Yeah.
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 Well, I've had a few days to think about my top three and I only have two.
I've got you covered with a fourth.
Thank you so much. I just want to reel up with Agathis robusta. I love it
that's
much.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
And one of my favourite individuals is the one at Burnley Gardens.
Yeah.
Like I hug it every time I see it.
It's enormous.
It's enormous.
They look like elephant feet or something. They've got that weird sort of almost buttressy.
Yes.
It's probably the wrong term technically, but they get those big kind of feet.
Yeah. Yes. And Eucalyptus woodwardii, I have a massive
Oh, my God, stunning.
That is a good one.
Like, someone work out how to graft that so I can put that in my clay soil, please.
We've tried growing them so many times at work and there's so many half-dead ones all over the place.
Mm. Yeah. My brother lives down Bayside and he's got sandy soils and we're going to put some in.
Yep.
Fingers crossed for you because a good one of those is just
I know they are. They're
so pretty.
You could have a crack at, like, Striglandii or something in the clay.
Okay.
Like, not quite the same habit. Like, woodwardii is quite sort of almost weepy and
weepy,
not dense
and grey, and then
yeah.
just like the flamboyant yellow flowers.
Yeah.
Mm. And those like crisp white stems.
Yes. Mm. Jacob, our producer, has put in a message saying, I'm a bit insulted that no one has mentioned Angophora costata.
True.
It means every time, great shade tree, fantastic branching and stunning bark.
Yep. That's a good call.
Yep.
And
great tree.
When you go up to Sydney in the sandstone country.
So good.
Oh, my God, they're incredible. And because you get that really heavy rain, like watching the change of bark colour, like to almost like a deep purple and pink, you know, and there's some of these trees are, I don't know how they're still standing, but they're massive and they kind of branch almost at right angles out of the cliffs. Yeah. Oh.
It's just wild.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah. Yeah, thumbs up for Jacob. Listener name says they grew up in Lismore. CSIRO has just released a report suggesting that flood mitigation upstream of Lismore could be addressed with up to 10 mega detention dams on tributaries in the catchment. They reckon displacing flooding in upstream bush, rural farms and small communities and changing landscape level systems ecology is a good idea, and the community is pretty outraged.
What a wild direction to go.
Yep.
That's a hard left turn.
Yeah. Yep. It's 9:10. I wish we could go into this further.
Yeah. That is a really fascinating direction to take it.
Yeah, I think we know that damming rivers is not...
Doesn't work.
Yeah.
From an ecological perspective, it's always a disaster.
Ecologically, yeah. Never works well.
No.
They've finished on a strong note, though.
Very strong note.
On great trees. Forest Kwandong with their amazing seeds.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Castanospermum australe have the gorgeous orange flowers and the huge bean pods.
Yeah, nice.
That's a good call. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Such a great tree.
Yeah. Adrian, can we get to the Banksia that you brought in? Because I brought in a Banksia too.
I know, I saw that.
Yes.
Yeah, is that Sentinel?
No, this is Banksia integrifolia, green cape form from Karanga.
Ooh.
It has a darker green leaf and an amber-coloured flower.
Upright form?
Yes.
Love it.
It's like a large, medium to large shrub. I'm so excited for it. I've got two in the garden now.
Wonderful.
Yes. Also, it gives you some joy in winter.
Oh,
you know, when
amen.
Yeah.
You know, your couriers do that too.
Yes.
But Banksia's in winter. It's like, oh, thank you.
I know.
I needed some flowers in my life.
Needed
you know?
A bit of something just to get me through.
Yes. Yeah. But the Banksia you brought in.
So the one I've brought in is a rare one as well. It's Banksia saxicola, or the rock Banksia. This is found... Very weird distribution, the Grampians and Wilson's Prom.
Mm. I love it so much. Mm.
It's a crazy disjunction.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. There's quite a bit of that.
Yeah.
Wilson's Prom and Grampians.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I always find fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, So I'm more familiar with this at Wilson's Prom, where there's a big grove of them growing as you walk into Sealer's Cove. And the ones at Wilson's Prom are growing in really weird conditions because it's on a south-facing slope and it's basically rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
And they grow quite differently, from my understanding, to the ones in the Grampians, which are much more exposed and...
There's some that are, like, kind of almost understory-like in the Grampians. Like, when you go up towards... they're sort of scattered through the Victoria Range. Mm. So the really big ones are in, like, kind of damper... Like, not quite gullies, but, like, damper sides and south sides and stuff.
And then
there's others that are a bit more exposed. Yeah.
Interesting.
But some of the leaf variation in...
Well,
saxicola
is today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's a very variable plant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And even the flower colour. So you can get almost blue like purples and greens and all sorts of stuff.
It's a cool one.
Yeah.
And for anyone listening, it looks superficially like an integrifolia and then you start looking more and more at it and you're like, hang on.
Mm.
Yeah.
This is not integrifolia. This is a saxicola. So it's a wonderful plant. The only place I know that you can get it from is good old Karunga. They do special orders of it that they release probably once or twice a year. I would not recommend it in the ground unless you're a super plantsman. It's probably better off as a large pot plant because it's a tricky one to grow.
Just we are running out of time, but tips for if it is in a pot, does it need to be a bit on the drier side?
It needs summer moisture. So give it every couple of days, give it a nice little drink. In winter, just make sure it doesn't get wet at the base.
Okay. Oh, that was easy. Thank you very much. Guys, we've come to the end of
another
show. I know,
and there is all the questions are turning up now.
I know. Look, if anyone wants to get involved in tree planting activities, there is a lot going on today. Just jump on to National Tree Day website. They've got a map on there and you can zoom in to wherever you are, and there's tree planting activities like all over Melbourne and all over Australia. So, yeah, get involved.
Mm.
Well, well done, guys.
I can't believe it's over.
Yeah, wait,
I just a very,
we finished at 9:30.
A very quick shout out to Tash with Stenocarpus sinuatus, the Queensland firewheel tree.
Yeah. Fab choice.
The first Latin name I ever learnt.
Oh, cute.
You know,
it's a good one.
Fantastic tree.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Thank you to Jacob Coventry Poole, Pia Lefebvre, keeping us in line in the studio today. Thank you to Russell Lark and Adrian Keane.
Thanks, Chloe.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys. We'll be back again at 7:30 next week. Have a great day, guys.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.